Okay, what we're going to do tonight is I have all the material to finish all the kings of Judah. If we get to it, we get to it. If not, we don't. There's quite a bit. I think we're going to look at 16 kings. There's some material, some kings we know a lot, but like Amon and Jehoiakim, there's not a lot. They reign really shortly. They're kind of just assassinated. Mostly bad. We got a couple kings that are going to be decent. Josiah is going to be really neat, especially with how young he is and what he has to deal with because of his father. So we'll look at as much as we can, and then maybe I'll throw a sermon together, or we'll come back at a later time because we got our summer series starting next week with being successful. So we got me and Paul, and then a whole bunch of other guys. Mike?
Do we have a list of who's appreciated?
Dr. Rocky? Rocky can email it or maybe post it. Can you post it on Facebook?
Yeah.
Maybe post on Facebook so we can all see a copy of it. Yeah, different guys coming in. So great question. So we got quite a bit of guys coming in. I got a lot of material on Manasseh, but it's really just kind of the first several chapters. So open up to 2 Kings chapter 20. Hezekiah has now gone to sleep with his fathers, has passed away. This is after his extended of life of 15 years, after he prayed to God, and God heard his prayers, heard his tears, and said, I'm going to give you 15 more years to serve me and to be king. And so there's 15 more good years. And now so we slowly start after Hezekiah is really in his reign, just fixed up all the corruption, all the golden calves, the pagan gods, all the stuff. He's really cleaned it up and has kind of set Judah back on the path of the way of God and really the way of David and kind of in his legacy and his reign. And so now we've gotten to the point where we're going to start the disintegrating process like we looked with the children of Israel and the kingdom of Israel as they've slowly deteriorated to where God just said, all right, I've had enough. Captivity it is. You haven't learned your lesson. And so kind of his plan. So Hezekiah has passed, and now his son Manasseh is going to be taken over. And he's going to be 12 years old when he becomes king. And he's going to reign, I think, for the second or the longest after the divided kingdom of 55 years in Jerusalem from 697 to 642 BC. Manasseh is going to be well known for using the Ten Commandments, which we'll note several of the Ten Commandments, as using them as kind of loose guidelines. He's actually going to take, and we'll look at the kind of the violations of each one, and he's just going to be like, I don't care about that commandment. I don't care about that commandment. Who cares about that murder one or serving other gods or whatever? He's just going to do what he wants. And so he's going to be, we called a couple of kings ago, we called Jotham and Ahaz the worst kings. I need to amend that. This guy is going to be one of the worst ones. And so his designation in verse 2 is going to be, he did evil in the sight of the Lord in 2 Kings 21, according to all the abominations of the nations whom the Lord dispossessed. And so he's going to follow the complete opposite of Hezekiah, of David, and really the law, and he's just going to kind of doing his own thing and follow. There's going to be some influence of Egypt. There's going to be some influence of Syria. And then I think maybe some flavor of the Amorites is going to be mixed in there as well. So he's going to really take the best of everything outside of God and said, hey, that sounds good. Let's apply it to my kingdom. Debbie? Yeah. I don't know. Maybe God has plans for something along that line. Yeah, well, I mean, we do still have to hold the promise that he gave to David, that as long as there's going to be a kingdom, that you know someone from David's lineage is going to be there. But it kind of shows that, you know, we talk about and people accuse the God of Old Testament as being jealous and angry, not tolerant and not loving. I mean, he puts up with this for a while for his people. So maybe, and just saying, maybe there were good people. Maybe still left over from Hezekiah's time that maybe put up some fight. We don't know. Maybe that's a good question. I'll put that down in my book to ask God after I get to Heaven's Gates. That, hey, what was going on here in 2 Kings 21? But Manasseh means, and I think of any name that means something that can apply to a king, it's him. It means he that is forgotten or forgetfulness. He has just completely forgotten God and forgotten what when he became king was taught to him, what his father taught, what the several kings before him. He has just completely forgotten this. We talk about how they're going to be, their reign's going to be remembered. If you want to turn over, Jeremiah 15 talks about Manasseh, but this is what God says because of his 55-year reign and what he does. This is going to be his legacy and what he's going to do to the children because of what he led them to when they followed. He says, I will make them an object of horror among all the kingdoms of the earth because of King Manasseh, the son of Hezekiah, the king of Judah, for what he did in Jerusalem. And so, as we know with history, after his reign, several other kings, some puppet kings are going to be put in there, but they're eventually going to be led into captivity. So let's get into those specific things of what he did. Just really quickly, I have six slides or six violations that we can look at. We can look at it. But first one's just the violation of Bible authority. In Deuteronomy 12 and verse 11, it says, in that place where your Lord, your God shall be, there you shall bring all that I commanded you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, and the contribution. Well, we already know that Israel has just completely ignored this part of Moses' law and Moses' teaching, because if you go back to 2 Kings 17, right after Assyrians have brought in, we learn that Israel was doing things secretly which were not right. In verse 10, they set themselves sacred pillars of Asherim on every high hill and under every green tree, and they burn incense on all the high places as a nation. So we already seen this. We know Israel's doing it. Now what Manasseh is going to do is he's going to bring it into his reign and into Judah. So in 2 Kings 21 and verse 3, if you want to read with me there, it says, Manasseh, which is going to be the 14th king of Judah, rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah, his father, had destroyed. And what was interesting to notice, Hezekiah was the first one to finally get rid of the high place worship. It had been something that had eluded all of the good kings before him. They had decided that the kings would take care of the temple and maybe in Jerusalem, but they wouldn't be able to take care of the high places. And Hezekiah finally was able to get rid of that worship. And so he decided, well, Dad doesn't know what he's doing, or I'm going to do it my own way, and I'm going to rebuild that, and we're going to do some more things in the temple. Mike? Macaulay, sorry. Sure. So semantics a little bit, but yeah, we can put the Torah there as well. But really they had as we'll look, that the word's going to be burned. So it was actual scrolls. So in the word of Moses, but the Torah as well. So specific violation, he's just puts in the kind of the high places. And just really quickly, so the second one is the violation is going to be the Baal and Asherah. So he's going to, in verse 3, he's going to erect altars for Baal and made of Asherah, as Ahab the king of Israel had done, which goes against one of the commandments in Exodus 20 and verse 4. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of which is in heaven above or on earth or beneath of the water. And so he said, all right, let's just ignore that and do it how Ahab did and what he did there. So another violation, just kind of continuing on with that. If you turn over to 2 Kings 21 and verse 7, he's going to carve that image of the Asherah that he made, and he's going to put it in the house of the Lord. So it's not like we're just worshiping these idols, but we're going to put it in where God has specifically said that that's not where it's supposed to go. And we find out later with Josiah, and we'll look at more of this later, but Josiah is going to have to break down the houses of male cult prostitutions that are going on in the house of the Lord that we find out that this guy established there. So even going beyond just having the Baal and the Ashram and Asherah there, there's male prostitution going on. And so he used the temple of the Lord that was supposed to be a house of ritual as just as sacred prostitution by kind of his design, just completely forgetting God. So a third violation is going to be, he's going to worship the sun, and really it's going to describe as the host of heavens. But in verse 5, it says, then Manasseh built altars for all the host of heavens in the two courts of the house of the Lord, violating Exodus 20 and verse 3. It says, you shall have no other gods before me. Moses even warns the people in his letter, says, beware lest you lift up your eyes to heaven and see the sun and the moon and the stars and all the host of heavens and be drawn away and worship them and serve them. Now, I tried to do some work. The Egyptians, especially King Tut and his predecessors, they worshiped one god, and that was the sun god, and they would do away with all the other gods. So they would just kind of worship one god. But in this setting, and what he did is they would worship the sun, the moon, and then they would worship the stars that they could see. So really, anything that was in the skies, they would have something to worship it. But we have more specifically known is sun worship and the god there. So said, well, I'm not going to just worship God. I'm going to worship all that I can. And then this won't be the first time we see it, but he's going to have a specific violation of human sacrifice. And in 2 Kings 21 and verse 6, and he said, and he made his sons pass through fire. It's not the first time we've run into this. This would have been a Molech, the pagan god that they would have followed. Leviticus 18 and verse 21 says, neither shall you give of your offspring to offer them to Molech, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. And also in Deuteronomy 18 and verse 10, there shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or daughter pass through fire. Just first of all, it's mind-blowing that Moses would have had to have dealt with this. And then now that we're actually seeing it and seeing kings actually doing it, I did more research because we talked about it last week. And I mentioned that I wasn't sure if they did it because they wanted to not have a line of succession. They'd take the firstborn, maybe the first male born, and kill that so they wouldn't have an immediate child like Athaliah did with her grandchildren, so they weren't able to take over and be the heir to the seat. I did a little bit more research into that, and it's unclear, but most would have known that this was just part of the worship. That you just, if you were going to worship Molech, one of the things he demanded of his followers was this kind of sacrifice. Meaning that, well, do you take me seriously? Do you take me serious enough that you'll do your own children? So we don't know exactly if it's because of the line of succession, but I thought about Isaiah 5:20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. So he was corrupt devotion of human sacrifice. And then going even farther, there was occult participation. In verse 6, Manasseh practiced witchcraft and used divination and dealt with mediums and spiritists. And he did much evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. And we know in Deuteronomy 18 and verse 10, and with King Saul, we see this the kind of practice of divination and spirits when he went to the lady in Endor. It says, there shall not be found among one who uses divination, who practices witchcraft, omens, sorcery, and goes on and on of all that kind of mysticism. And so he says, okay, well, I'm just going to go that way and we'll follow that one. And so probably the worst violation he has is murder and really persecution. The Ten Commandments says, you shall not murder. Hosea says of this time in chapter 4 and verse 2, it says, there was swearing, deception, murder, stealing, adultery. They employ violence so that bloodshed follows bloodshed. And you can imagine just kind of a sea of blood. And that's exactly what Manasseh did. In verse 16, It says, moreover, Manasseh shed very much innocent blood until he filled Jerusalem from one end to another. Just a complete wicked king. And so I was thinking maybe he was due a death of Ahab or due a death of Jezebel or something really worthwhile. But we kind of see, and that's why I put up there, we've been noting the red for a bad king and a blue for a good king, that towards the end of his life, he's going to be punished for this, and there's going to be a little bit of blue that comes out of him, that he's going to be somewhat. In Hebrews 12 and verse 11 says, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. So let's look and see how that applies. Turn over to 2 Chronicles 33. We'll take a look at this. So he is then going to be, because of this, and God has gotten angry, he's had enough. God doesn't want to deal with this anymore, that there needs to be punishment. It was just kind of interesting to note the kind of the slow progression that Manasseh is on, that it keeps getting gradually worse and worse and worse. And so God's going to send in the Assyrians, and he's going to be taken captive, and he's going to be brought to Babylon in verse 11. But know what happens when he is imprisoned in verse 12. And when he was in distress, he entreated, he prayed to the Lord his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers. And when he prayed to him, he was moved by his entreaty and heard his supplication and brought him again to Jerusalem. I can only imagine, and we've probably all been there, but when I remember, I mean, I thought I heard cops, sirens, and I knew I was doing something wrong, and I was sitting in my car, and I remember praying, God, just this one time, I pray, let the cops not find me. I don't want to go to jail. I don't want to face dad. I don't want to get kicked out of the house. I'll do anything to get out of this. I won't do it again. I promise. And maybe God heard my cries, or someone didn't call the cops on me, whatever it may have been. But I entreated him, and he heard my prayers. And so it's just interesting to see that after all of what he did, he still had some knowledge or some remembrance that, okay, there is one true God, that all the stuff I was doing was wrong. There was probably definitely a prayer of forgiveness, and he entreated God, and God knew him, and that Manasseh knew that the Lord was God. And so he's going to retake this newfound faith or renew sense of godliness in his life, and he's going to do some really neat things. So in verse 15, he gets back to Jerusalem, and he also removed the foreign gods and the idol from the house of the Lord, as well as all the altars which he had built on the mountain of the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, and he threw them outside the city. And he set up the altar of the Lord and sacrificed peace offerings and thank offerings on it. And he ordered Judah to serve the Lord God of Israel. I mentioned last Sunday morning in my sermon on how to get excited, and Jesus says is to repent. That's doing a complete 180 and going back the other way and doing what you've done kind of before. That's exactly what it seems like Manasseh's doing. He says, oh man, I messed up. I got in trouble. I realized that wasn't the way. Moloch wasn't coming down to save him. Baal and the Asherim weren't going to save him, but the one true living God, Yahweh, Elohim, is going to be the one that saves me. Jim? Yeah. Yeah, but Jim, that's a great point, especially in today's time where, man, we see evil people all around us, and man, I sometimes fall short in this area. I just think, oh, they're going to hell, or there's no saving that person, or that person's a completely lost cause, and I've said that even out loud, and I mean, I'm thinking Manasseh's the worst of all, and yet God even can change him and use him. And even at the rock bottom of where he's at, God could use him. God used a harlot and a prostitute. And so not every single person is a lost cause. Debbie? Yeah, yeah. That kind of, that answers our question, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. God causes all things to work together for good. Yeah. Yeah, or we can inflict something else on someone else's life. And yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought about that, but that kind of answers your question, that God maybe had seen it, that maybe he was going to be the one that does clean up his own act and gets back on there. So it's really neat. And so what's interesting to know, and we've talked about the high places over and over and over again, look at this. He put it back in there. Hezekiah had gotten rid of it. Manasseh puts the worshiping in the high places back into it. But note that in verse 17, it says the people still sacrificed in the high places. Oh, man, he was doing so good, couldn't get it. No, actually, he did. Although only to the Lord their God. And so he even changed into the high places. And so we have this red-blue kind of thing where it starts out very negative and then ends up hitting rock bottom and then having a change of heart, going back to God. And so we know for sure that it's never too late. A 55-year-old or a 65-year-old guy sitting out there, just maybe you've known all your life, that's just said, "Now I'm not going to follow God. I'm not going to do that stuff." But maybe his heart can change. I know my uncle Bill, before he passed, staunch was against the church. Just wasn't going to go, didn't care. Got on his sick bed. He had been baptized a long time ago, kind of with someone, just repented and said, "Well, I'm wrong." And so maybe, who knows? We'll see when we get up there. Maybe that God took him. But, you know, even after all those years, really realize that, okay, there is a God and he's there, and maybe I've messed up. So we kind of see this flip-flop of, or a total flip of Manasseh. So I didn't put any animation, so we're going to look at Amon, which is going to be the next king. So Manasseh is going to eventually pass and be put to death, and then Amon's going to become king, and he's going to reign for 2 years in Jerusalem. Not a lot to Amon at all. Really what we know is he's going to forsake the Lord, the God of his fathers, Hezekiah, Manasseh, David, and he's not going to walk in the way of the Lord, and there's going to be no coming back from it from him, because he's not going to really get the chance, because the people are going to get sick of it, and as the servants of Amon are going to conspire against him. And note this, that they're going to kill the king in his own house. We've had several different killings on battlefields, in front of the people, execution style, being wounded and then running away. They pass on the journey. He gets just assassinated in his own house, probably a planned attack. And so 2 Chronicles account in chapter 33 and verse 23 says, "Moreover, he did not humble himself like Manasseh did." Said he humbled himself before the Lord. Amon doesn't, and he, as his father Manasseh done, but Amon multiplied guilt, and he just went far and beyond. And so they're eventually going to be taken care of, and he's only going to only reign just a few short years. And so, all right, let's get to the neatest king we're going to look at tonight. The most probably positive king is going to be Josiah. A really neat king. He's going to become king at 8 years old. I know people here have grandchildren that are older than 8 years old. I tried to picture myself at eight. I was in, second grade, becoming, hey, the people, hey, you're ready to become king. You're ready to lead the people that have just had a very wicked king that are not following God's ways, are serving other gods, that are serving the Baal, serving the Asherim, that are doing all these right things. And so he's going to become the 16th king of Judah. And what's really just interesting to notice is spiritual disposition. In 2 Kings 22, so it's flipping back over to 2 Kings, or maybe No, stay there in 2 Chronicles. We'll just read that on the board. He said, and he did right in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of his father David. Note this, nor did he turn to the right or to the left. Said, I'm not going to go all the way to the left. I would describe that as I'm not going to be a liberal Christian or a liberal king. I'm not going to go to the far as right and be a conservative king. I'm going to go right down the middle, and I'm going to serve God the way he would want me to, the way he says, and I'm going to do the best that I can and do right in his sight. And so I appreciated kind of the phrasing of that. You turn over to 2 Chronicles, just one more chapter over in 34. He's going to start at 8, and then in his 8th year, so at age 16, I mean, he's still a youth, he's still young. He began to seek the God of his father, David. So just really neat that even at such a young age, is just realizing that this is the right place for me to go, and this is where I need to carry my reign. And so, and then in the second part of that, in the 12th year, so at age 20, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem of all the high places, the Asherim, the carved images, the molten images, and they tore down the altars of Baal and just starting to slowly eliminate all of what Amon had put in. And so with the kings of Judah, it feels like it's a battle back and forth. One king puts it in there, another king takes it out, another king puts it in, another king takes it out. And so we go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. He's also in verse 7, he's going to tear down the altars throughout all the land of Israel. So just a really neat young man who I tried to look, and it's not known if he did a lot of decision making at age 8. Maybe he was just there and he had kind of like the previous young kings before him had spiritual guidance and spiritual counselors and people that are just kind of looking over him as he's 8 years old. Even for then, I don't know how much he could to say about leading a people in war and tactics and all that stuff. But as he got slowly grew older, was able to make these decisions and kind of cleanse all of what Amon had put in. And so, as we noted earlier in verse 70, he's going to break the houses of male prostitutes, which were in the temple. In verse 8, he's going to repair the temple. Amon's probably going to let that go to waste. He says, well, there's no point. I'm going to guess the male prostitutes aren't going to be too careful of how things look around there or upkeep of the godly things that are supposed to be in there, so they probably let it go. There wasn't much upkeep, and so the temple's going to be repaired under his. What's interesting to note is the law is going to be found, which means it was lost, and so he's going to find it. He's going to put it at the center of his reign. The other thing is the Ark of the Covenant, that's going to be returned. We don't know where it was taken to, but it's going to be brought back. Maybe they moved it out to move in the male prostitutes and all the altars that were in there. They moved it out. Maybe they moved it out of the holy places and put it somewhere else. Don't know, but they're going to return it back to where it was. And then what's interesting to note is then the Passover, which has been neglected, is then now going to be celebrated. You can look, and maybe at another time, look at verses 1 through 19. They slaughtered the animals. They held all of what David is. They put the holy ark in the house of the Lord. And so it seems like Josiah is kind of bringing some normalcy, and I throw air quotes on that, going back to what Moses had done and what David had done. And so he's kind of bringing the people back to some way that God would have them to do. And so in verse 3, it says, and then the king made a covenant before the Lord to walk after the Lord, to keep his commandments, his testimonies, his statutes with all of his heart and all of his soul. And then, so what's interesting to note is, and then all the people entered that covenant as well. So Josiah is just a really, really neat guy here at the beginning to what he's done. And it's kind of refreshing to have a young person like this doing the way God would have him to do, walking in the way of the God of David and all these things. And so he's going to be kind of the refreshing course. Now, what happens here is it kind of slowly starts to go downhill. It's just going to be all negative and negative and negative as we start to get into God's at the end of his leash here for the people, like he was with Israel. There's going to be the Assyrians coming in. The Babylonians are going to come in. The Egyptians are going to come up and cause issues. We did note, and we'll note here in a second, that Egypt's going to have problems with Manasseh, and that's kind of how his reign is ended. Josiah is going to have kind of the same thing here. So in 2 Chronicles 34 and in verse 28, it says, "And behold, I will gather to your fathers, and you shall be gathered to your grave in peace. So your eyes will not see all the evil which I will bring in this place and on its inhabitants." And I brought the word back to the king. And so that was coming from the words of Hilkiah, which was of the king of Babylon, I believe, back there. And so we still have to remember what Jeremiah said of Manasseh, right? What did God promise or say that of Manasseh? That God's going to punish the people for the sins of his of what he has done in most of his reign. And so we kind of see that. So in 2 Kings 23 and verse 29, Pharaoh Necho of Egypt is going to go up against the king of Assyria to the river Euphrates, and Josiah is going to see this as a kind of a thought of war. He's really going up to Assyria, but we find a note from here that Josiah has maybe gotten into league with the Assyrians. We make that kind of deduction. And so when Pharaoh Necho is going to see him, he's going to kill him at Megiddo. And so Manasseh had sided with Egypt and was imprisoned by Assyrians. Josiah is going to side with Assyrians and he's going to be killed by Egyptians. So no matter what, where you side outside of God, it's going to bring some kind of issue when you go outside of those things. And we remember that promise that we just read in 2 Chronicles 34 and 28. Her eyes shall not see all the evil which I bring on Jerusalem. And so starting with this promise to Josiah, now we kind of see the promise to what God said through Jeremiah to Isaiah through to and about Manasseh is kind of the beginning of the end. And so turning over back to 2 Kings 23, Josiah has now been murdered by the king of Egypt by Necho in battle. And so now we see that his son, Jehoahaz, who we've already run across, his name's also going to be Shallum. And so we have kind of that name crossing here as well. But Jehoahaz is going to be anointed, and he's going to take hold and be king. Now, it says here, note in verse 30, 2 Kings 23 and verse 30, and it says, "And his servants drove the body in a chariot from Megiddo and brought him to Jerusalem and buried him in his own tomb. And Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he became king, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his fathers had done." And so he's going to be 23, he's going to be a young man, and he's going to reign 3 months. We've been in the king study for 3 months, so that's about as long as he's going to reign. He's going to do evil in the sight of the Lord. As we're going to know, all the kings after this are going to be evil. Necho's not going to like this too much. Josephus says at this point in the book of Antiquities about him, he says, "He was an impious man, impure in his course of life. He was neither religious towards God nor good-natured towards men." So really, it's just all about himself, Josephus says. He says, "Oh, he's not going to treat men right. He's not going to treat God right." So it's going to be all about Jehoahaz and what he has. And so in verse 3, that Necho's not going to like this. He's going to imprison him at Riblah, which if you note up here on the map, is kind of way up there in the north from Jerusalem. So quite a bit of journey there. But he's going to imprison him up there. And then Josephus is going to continue. And as the king of Egypt returned from battle, he sent for Jehoahaz to come to him, put him in the bands, and carried him to Egypt, where he died. And so he wasn't friendly towards God, which we already know is going to cause you issues in the first place. But now you're not going to be friendly towards men, maybe men of his own kingdom, men of the other kingdoms around. So if you have no friends, I'm surprised he lasts 3 months at all. We've had a king that lasted a week at one point, but just really kind of a just a horrible king. And as we get kind of down to the nitty gritty here, so the 18th king of Judah is going to be Jehoiakim, not Jehoiachin, who's going to be next, but Jehoiakim. In 2 Kings 23 and verse 34. And then Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in place of Josiah, his father, and changed his name to Jehoiakim. Now, what's interesting to know about this, and Pulpit says about that, well, why the name change? Well, I'm thinking it's kind of a, the Pulpit calls it a mark of suggestion or subjection, but maybe to say, hey, I own you, that you're mine, and whenever someone calls you by your name or says who you are, that you remember that I gave you that name. And so, he left the choice of the name to himself. Pulpit also continues going on, and this is kind of just some interesting thoughts, but El from Eliakim is general name for God, like Elohim, El. And then the J-E-H from Jehoiakim is specific name of Yahweh. And so kind of see the God names kind of put in there. But Jehoiakim is going to be 25 when he becomes king, or when he's placed in to become king. And he's going to reign 11 years in Jerusalem. And as we'll note, as we keep doing the deterioration of the kingdom and of Judah, he's going to do evil in the sight of the Lord. And in 2 Kings 24 and verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, comes up, and Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years. So just kind of hot potato and passing around. Then he turned and rebelled against him. And the Lord sent against him bands of Chaldeans, Arameans, Moabites, Ammonites, and he sent them against Judah to destroy it. And so even he's evil in the sight of the Lord, and then he starts to rebel against really the guys who have put him into power, of Nebuchadnezzar and Necho. If you start to anger them, you start to upset them, your reign's going to be kind of, it's going to be shortened. And so Jehoiakim, turn over to Jeremiah 36. So we kind of see, that's all we get from Kings and Chronicles right there. But if you look at the contemporaries and look around there, we kind of see some of the information and the parts put in there, fill in some of the gaps. Like in Jeremiah, and also, I think it's Daniel chapter 1 he's mentioned. That'll be on the next slide. We see some of the parts that were missing. So in Jeremiah 36 and in verse 1, in his reign, we noted earlier, but in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, the word came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, take a scroll and write it on all the words which I have spoken to you concerning Israel and concerning Judah and concerning all the nations from the day I first spoke to you, from the days of Josiah even to this day. And then in verse 3, perhaps the house of Judah will hear all the calamity which I plan to bring on them, which all of what Jeremiah has been writing about, all the previous 35 verses, and so which I plan to bring on them, in order that every man will turn from his evil way, then I will forgive their iniquity and their sin. Just to humor me, turn over to Jeremiah 29. And look at verse 11. This is slowly becoming my God has given you more than you can handle bit that Debbie has. But in Jeremiah 29 and verse 11, we just noted in Jeremiah 36 that God has said all of what I've talked about, All of previously, Jeremiah, what I've spoke to you about in the reign of Josiah, going all the way back to Jehu, all of what I've talked about, all the calamity and the things that I have ready for Israel, what's they're already being undertake, they're already in captivity, what I'm going to have in store for Judah, I want you to read it to Jehoiakim so maybe he can maybe realize, hey, I don't want that to be either under my reign, I don't want that to happen to my people, I kind of would like to pass the buck on to someone else, or maybe I can kind of stop that. But in Jeremiah 29 and verse 11 says, "For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope." Wow, that sounds not a lot like calamity. That sounds pretty good. Look at the context of what God is saying to Jeremiah. It says, well, we're talking about the downfall of his children, of two kingdoms. And God's saying, I have plans for you as welfare and calamity. Well, that doesn't sound like, because we look in a few verses later in chapter 36, that's what he has planned right away. Well, if you look back, I think a few verses earlier, he talks about it not being right away, but 70 years from now after the captivity of his people. And so it's just interesting to note that we can kind of maybe take things a little bit out of context. And so if you ever tell someone, hey, I know the plans that God has for you. It's for welfare, not for calamity. But in 70 years, that's a nice burn right there. So if you really don't like someone, but overall, the just kind of the nice scripture there. But we can see that. And so Isaiah is going to write down all the words as he's done here that we have. He's going to take it to Jehoiakim. And really, Jehoiakim's kind of going to laugh at it. And there's going to be a fire going. So imagine he takes it and you got a fire pit in the backyard and someone brings all these words of negative and crushing and captivity. And the people are going to pay for what they've done. And Manasseh is going to pay for the sins that he did. And he's going to laugh it off. And there's just going to be a brazier there. And he's going to kind of throw it in there. And it came about after the reading of it, the king cut it with the scribe's knife and threw it in the fire. In the brazier until all the scroll was consumed in the fire that was in the brazier. Yet the king and all of his servants had heard all these words, were not afraid, nor did they rend their garments. And so there was, ha, 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 no jokes here. We don't care. So turn over, you can turn over, I have them all on the thing, but to Daniel chapter 1. So in 606 B.C., Daniel writes, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. We see that from the logs of the kings. And then in verse 2, it says, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hands. And along with some of the vessels of the house of God, he brought them into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And we can see that in 2 Chronicles. Including some of the royal family and the nobles, youths in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligent, and every branch of wisdom. Sounds kind of familiar, maybe like Daniel. And so kind of what Daniel is going to be talking about here. So this is all under Jehoiakim's reign. And so kind of see the interconnectings that, you know, the Bible is not just one linear kind of straightforward thing, that there is some kind of connection, and it's just neat to see that this is all a part of that. So looking at kind of some secular and some other ways of looking at this, Unger's, which is just and McClintock, which are just Bible dictionaries and Bible commentaries, Nebuchadnezzar released Jehoiakim from Babylon, and actually he's going to reinstate him and treating him as a vassal king. And so but then later he's gonna rebel, and he's then gonna be taken by the Babylonians and besieged that. So even after he's given a quote unquote second chance, he still fumbles it. Josephus says a little afterward, the king of Babylon made an expedition against Jehoiakim, whom he received into the city, supposing that he should suffer nothing terrible. Was commanded to be thrown outside the city walls without any burial. And so some kind of authors are illustrators' depiction of the battle. And so Unger's and McClintock will also say, and after being dragged away, after he was and he was buried outside the Jerusalem with a donkey's burial. not in the kings, not, you know, maybe not with the kings, but in kind of the area, but just outside of the city. And really what a donkey's barrel is, there's no pomp, there's just no loud lamentation, there's no sorrow, let's just put him in the ground, let's not worry about it, take care of it. We had dogs, labs, when we were kids, and it'd be kind of like when they get a bird or a squirrel, they just dig a hole and bury it and move on, and there's some good nutrients for the ground, and see, I don't really even care about it anymore. It's exactly the burial that Jehoiakim is going to have, and that's going to be how he's kind of remembered forever. So let's look at the next king. We're actually going to get pretty close to getting all these guys. We have two more kings left. So Jehoiachin, not a lot about him. He's going to be 18 years old when he becomes king in 2 Kings 24. And he's going to reign 3 months in Jerusalem. And he's going to do evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father had done. Apple not far and far from the tree. And at that time, turning back over to 2 Kings 24, we're going to see Nebuchadnezzar pass mentioned again, and he's going to be kind of prevalent over the next several chapters, him and Necho and the pharaohs of Egypt. And then, so in 2 Kings 24 and verse 10, and at that time the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, went up to Jerusalem, and the city came under siege. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to the city with his servants, war besieging it. And then Jehoiachin, the king of Judah, in verse 12, went out to the king of Babylon, and he and his mother and his servants and his captives and his officials. So the king of Babylon took him captive in his 8th year of reign. And so just offering up every important person, the royal family, the royal guard, the king, we'll just grab him and take him out. And so we're looking at 597 BC, which is an important date. And then Nebuchadnezzar is going to carry away the treasures of the house of the Lord in the king's house. He's going to cut into pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, just as the Lord had said. Then he led them away into exile, all Jerusalem, all the captains and the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives, all the craftsmen and smiths. None remain except the poorest people of the land. And so they're taken off into the first Babylonian captivity, dated 597. And so kind of the beginning of the end here. So now we're just kind of living on last little bated breath here. So we're going to get back into it. So the last king's going to be Zedekiah. In chapter 24 and verse 17, and then the king of Babylon made his uncle king in his place and changed his name to Zedekiah. And so this guy is going to be given the task of being a king over, I'm going to guess, someone he doesn't want, but he's going to make his uncle do it. And his uncle's going to be 21 years old, which is interesting to note. That's a young uncle, but Zedekiah is going to be 21 years old when he became king, and he's going to reign for 11 years in Jerusalem, so 597, 586, kind of connecting the dots between the two Babylonian captivities. And so in 25 and verse 1, it says, and now in the 9th year of his reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came and in all of his army against Jerusalem, camped against it and built a siege around the wall. So the city was under siege until the 11th year of the king of Judah. So almost 2 years siege. That's a long time for a siege. Which makes me believe, if we go back to Hezekiah, maybe the tunnel system or the spring outside, something has happened to where an army coming in there can easily have access to the water. Because that would have been one of the major debacles of having that large of an army come in there to siege Jerusalem, having food, water, and the equipment to take it down. But it's also interesting to note that why would Nebuchadnezzar have to come down there? The king of Babylon has already put in his uncle. It says, you're the puppet king. Well, maybe there's a little rebellion. Hey, I'm tired of listening to you. Maybe I'm tired of taking things from my nephew. I'm going to do it my way. And so they're going to capture him. They're going to capture the king in verse 6. And they're going to bring him to the king. And he's going to pass sentence on him. And in verse 7, and they slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, the brutality of it. Then they put out the eyes of Zedekiah and bound him with bronze fetters and brought him to Babylon. And so he's going to be blinded after seeing. So the last images Zedekiah is going to see are of his own children being murdered. I don't have children, but I'm parents, could you imagine that? I mean, that's brutal, but we're talking about a Babylonian king who's not really true in the lineage and just kind of a puppet master. But I mean, family doing that. It's your own family doing it to family and just the brutality of the nations around there. But just imagine that's his lasting images. So we get down to kind of the last three verses of the class and really of our time is 2 Kings 25 and verse 8. And so now on the seventh day of the month, a servant's going to go up, which was the 19th year of the king of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. A servant of the king of Babylon came to Jerusalem. So in verse 9, he burned the house of the Lord, the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem. Even every great house he burned with fire. So all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captain of the guard broke down the walls around Jerusalem. And the rest of the people who were left in the city and the deserters who had deserted to the king of Babylon and the rest of the people, Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the temple guard, or the captain of the guard, carried away into exile. And so now we see officially both kingdoms of the divided kingdom, all of the beginning from Saul and David and Solomon here are in captivity, what God has been promising over and over and over again, that if they don't change the way, that was going to be the end. So that's our journey through the Kings. Debbie?